Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from People Mover. Help update the public transit service plan. Visit transitonthemove.com to take the latest public survey by April 26th.
This policy creates uncertainty at the exact moment Alaska needs more energy development.
The Alaska House rejects an effort to impose corporate income taxes on certain oil and gas companies. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 14th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, a new study aims to tackle the state's high rate of incarceration among Alaska Native people.
When we're looking at saying that we have these high rates, there's a number of things that need to be looked at and understood.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. A budget proposal that would provide $100 million to shore up schools and state facilities in dire need of repairs across Alaska is on its way to a full Senate vote. The Senate Finance Committee rolled out its capital budget on Monday and passed the bill out of committee this afternoon. The Senate's draft would require roughly $248 million in unrestricted funds, much of which would go towards shoring up schools and state facilities around Alaska. It's $88 million more than the governor proposed in December. The head capital budgeter in the state Senate, Republican Senator Bert Stedman of Sitka, says it represents roughly half of the final amount he hopes to see pass the legislature this year. Stedman says the Senate's draft seeks to spread dollars fairly around the state by leaning heavily on prioritized lists of projects developed by the governor's administration, rather than allowing legislators to pick and choose their favorites.
We're trying to deal with some of the massive deferred maintenance that's being compiled up for the state to deal with. And unfortunately, there isn't enough funds to have individual allocations to all our communities.
The budget includes about $100 million in deferred maintenance projects, more than half of which would go towards K-12 schools. Some $14 million would be set aside for repairs at Mount Edgecombe High School. Lawmakers decried, quote, deplorable conditions at the state-run boarding school after a visit earlier this year. It also provides millions in matching funds for federal projects. Along with federal funding and other restricted revenue, the bill would enable about $2.5 billion in total spending. Its next stop is the Senate floor. Meanwhile, the Alaska House rejected a state Senate effort to impose corporate income taxes on energy producer Hillcorp and other similarly structured oil and gas companies. The House floor vote illustrated a major policy disagreement between two bipartisan coalitions in the legislature dominated by Democrats. Leaders of the Senate majority have repeatedly pushed to impose new or higher taxes on oil and gas businesses in an effort to correct a structural budget deficit that emerged when oil prices crashed in the mid-2010s. But on Monday, four members of the slimmer bipartisan majority in the House explicitly rejected increasing taxes on companies developing the state's most lucrative natural resources.
We need to be careful to spend some time not singling out any particular company.
I don't support the addition of new taxes to this legislation.
Mr. Speaker, this policy creates uncertainty at the exact moment Alaska needs more energy development.
The voices there are of Representatives Chuck Kopp, an Anchorage Republican and the House Majority Leader, Elise Galvin, an Anchorage Independent, and Robin Freer, a Democrat from Utqiagvik. The measure failed 17-23. Last month, the Senate inserted the tax measure into a lower-profile bill, approving the sale of state-owned oil to Marathon Petroleum's Kenai refinery shortly before passing it. Since Alaska repealed its personal income tax in the 1980s, so-called S-corporations have been exempt from the state's corporate income tax. Backers of the change argued in the Senate that that leaves a loophole. While most oil and gas companies pay corporate income taxes, Hillcorp and other pass-through businesses do not. Most members of the bipartisan House majority voted in support of the change, including independent Anchorage Representative Kai Holland.
I believe this is a defining question for many of us who I think recognize that our state has moved past looking for the fiscal cliff and is now out beyond it. And it's now a time for us to decide, are we willing to take some difficult votes and take some difficult action?
The bill now heads back to the Senate, which can either vote to accept the House original version of the bill or set up a conference committee to work out a final draft. Alaska Native people make up less than 20% of Alaska's population, but they represent more than 40% of the state's prison population. And when they're released, Alaska Native people have a 60% chance of ending up back in prison, the highest rate of all racial and ethnic groups in the state, according to the Alaska Department of Corrections. As part of a crime bill passed by the legislature 2 years ago, the Department of Corrections contracted with the Alaska Federation of Natives to conduct a study looking at ways to reduce the overrepresentation of Alaska Native people in the state's prison population. The study was released recently. AFN's Director of Government Relations, Kendra Kloster, was part of the team that put the study together and joins us now. Hi, Kendra.
Hello.
So the report highlights a number of historic and ongoing issues that are leading to the state's disproportionate detention of Alaska Natives. Can you describe some of that background?
I think what's important here to first kind of set the stage in thinking about this, Alaska Native people had a restorative justice system where, you know, we're addressing and uplifting our youth and having our youth and elders together and growing up. And we had such a strong system in which there was support. When you come through colonization, you have a Western system that was built so much different than the way our Alaska Native people lived. You have a long history of trauma since contact that has been embedded into our communities. And those are traumas that are still living on today. And I think that that does have a lot of impacts onto what our current system is looking at. And so when we're looking at saying we have these high rates, there's a number of things that need to be looked at and understood.
You mentioned that one of the recommendations the study puts forward is the expansion of restorative justice programs. How do those programs work differently from more Western justice systems? And why do you think they'd produce better outcomes?
I'm going to give kind of an example to help maybe highlight this. Let's say our youth have we'll call it a youthful indiscretion, and they say go out and do vandalism. In a Western system, you're looking at more of like, we're going to go to a court appearance. You're going to have something on your record. You're going to be put down a path that is not really looking toward restoring individuals and really just understanding that what happened. So in our restorative kind of justice programs and through a tribal court, you would see these youth come into a circle with our elders, with our aunties, with our uncles. They will love you up in a very stern kind of way. They're going to say, you know, we love you. You messed up, though. And what you're going to do now is you're going to go back to those individuals and you're going to do something to make them whole. And you're going to understand what that is. Maybe that's going in and fixing what they vandalized. Maybe that's going in and fishing for that family. You're going to hold some personal accountability to yourself and to the community and understanding that. That is a restorative justice system where we're understanding, we're uplifting our youth, we are taking them and making them part of the solution to fix what went wrong.
So a part of the study talks about the importance of keeping people in their communities, especially when it comes to things like parole requirements. Why do you think staying close to home matters so much for addressing recidivism rates?
Through this study, when we did interviews and surveys, we talked with individuals, this was something that came up pretty often is, let's say if you're from a rural community and you're in an urban hub, you go into a correctional system and you come out and you have parole and probation requirements that are keeping you in the city. However, maybe your home base is where you're going to have a better chance. You might have a home there, you have family support, but yet these probation and parole violation and or requirements are not allowing you to go home, and you have to stay within that city. And if you don't have that support system, you could end up homeless. You could end up, you know, kind of re-back in the system because you don't have that support system. And so that had come up pretty often. And so that was one of the recommendations is, can we look at the probation and parole violations? What needs to change in there? And how are we supporting those individuals?
So in what ways do you think that the state can address some of these recommendations in sort of more immediate terms and then in the longer term?
Looking at the longer term, it's really looking at the preventative measures. And a lot of that is going to be putting effort into education, prenatal care, supporting parents. There is a lot of studies not just ours that we looked at. We did a literature review to see what other studies have said. And from, 20, 30 years ago, they're saying the same thing. This isn't new information. Is we really need to be making sure that we're supporting parents, that we're supporting kids from the very early ages. And I also want to say cultural programs play such an important role in our lives, especially for Native people. We are connected to land. We're connected to our hunting and to our fishing. This is part of our wellness. This is part of who we are and our spirituality. This is something that we've talked a lot about within other organizations, and even following up on the study, is how are we building that into our correctional facilities, giving people that are there that connection to their culture, because that is part of the healing process and it's being missed.
Kendra Kloster is the Alaska Federation of Natives Director of Government Relations. Thanks so much for joining us today.
So thank you.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, researchers and local experts study environmental challenges facing Western Alaska.
What conversations can we have this week that will connect us to a narrative of abundance and resilience?
That's ahead. Stay with us. The Alaska Air National Guard's 168th Wing now has a dozen aerial refueling planes after four more of the tankers arrived at Alsen Air Force Base earlier this month. And as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the Air Force also plans to assign an additional 200 active duty service members to the base.
The four KC-135 Stratotankers arrived earlier this month, and Eielson personnel are checking them over to ensure they're ready to begin regular service, says Air Guard Senior Master Sergeant Julie Avey. She's a spokesperson for the 168th Wing that operates the tankers.
We have them out on the tanker row, and we have our maintenance folks already starting to take a look at them and work them into the rotation. And so they are ready to be deployed out as needed.
Avey says the new aircraft will bolster the 168th Wing's ability to keep aircraft refueled during long-duration missions around the Arctic and the Indo-Pacific region.
Those four additional tankers are just to increase our air refueling capabilities that are currently needed to sustain the mission. So we're already working 24/7 operations, and with that comes additional aircraft and people that are needed just to sustain what we're already doing.
Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan says the mission has become more urgent in recent years, partly because of the growing need to refuel Alaska-based fighter jets and reconnaissance planes that track and intercept Russian aircraft flying through international airspace around the state. Sullivan said in a news release that Russian and Chinese aircraft and ships have become increasingly aggressive in the skies and waters around Alaska. Avey said that's just one facet of the 168th Wing's mission.
The aircraft are engaged with all sorts of military aircraft.
She says the Air Force plans to bring 200 service members to Eielson to help operate and maintain the four additional KC-135s. But the agency hasn't announced when they and their family members will arrive.
We will have some family members, but we don't have an idea of what that looks like at this time.
Avey says it's likely that some will live on Eielson as space is available, and some will live in outlying areas around the base. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Students from across the state visited Nome last weekend for the United Youth Courts of Alaska Conference. The organization brings together local youth court chapters for a weekend of learning about the law. KNOM's Ben Townsend has more.
It's been almost a decade since Nome last hosted the United Youth Courts of Alaska Conference. And with Nome hosting comes a few uniquely Nome elements, like the lighting of a traditional seal oil lamp known as a kulik to open the event. The fleshy but sweet smell of rendered seal fat wafts through the front of the room.
So this was how we heated our homes, but it's also become a symbol that connects us back to our ancestors and to our ways of life.
This is Megan Sigvana Topcock, one of the organizers of the conference. She's Inupiaq with family roots in Mary's Igloo and Nome. It's a jam-packed day with guest speakers and demonstrations. Alaska Supreme Court Justice Amy Aravic arrives in the afternoon to deliver the keynote speech.
You may not know today, and you may not know in a year, and you may not even know in 5 years, the potential good impact you're having. Youth Court has such a quiet and yet important impact on the work done in the justice system.
Aravik explains that of Alaska's 2,100 or so lawyers, only about 1,300 live in the state. And of those, even fewer want to be judges or represent a business. She encourages the young audience of about 65 students to get into the field using some hip language along the way.
And if you have any inkling whatsoever that you might like to do this for a career, I'm upvoting because Alaska needs lawyers.
The next morning, the students gather at the Nome Courthouse for a tour and mock sentencing. Rather than a traditional sentencing, the students take part in what Topcock calls circle peacemaking. Split into small groups, the students sit in a circle so everyone can see each other's faces. They're given a scenario and assigned characters to roleplay.
Turns out, in the fact pattern, that the reason the one boy had beaten up the other one was because the first boy had been making some comments about a dead sibling. And so he was trying to figure out how to process that grief, didn't take it out very well.
The students go in a circle, taking turns sharing their characters' perspectives on the incident.
I think we should give him a little bit of grace for that, but also it's just not acceptable to attack someone, a peer, or anyone really.
I think it's crude that somebody was talking about a passed away relative, so I really do understand on that level.
By the end, the group needs to make a unanimous decision on a punishment. The students settle on sentencing both the perpetrator and the victim to community service.
So what I heard in the circle that I was kind of sitting in with was, obviously violence is not the answer, and we're trying to hold people accountable with compassion, and that means realizing that, like, this is a much more nuanced situation.
Through her work as staff attorney at the tribal nonprofit Kowarik, Topcock holds circle peacemaking in villages across the Bering Strait region. She says unlike Western-style hearings, where having a relationship with the defendant generally bars you from participating.
Whereas in a circle, it's actually a strength. Yeah. It's not considered a conflict of interest. Like, we want people who are related. We want to pull them in. And because it's consensus-based, we can do that. It's not just one person making a decision on behalf of everybody. It's the group coming together and figuring out what is the best path forward.
Reflecting on a conference that filled up her cup, Topcock says she's even more optimistic for the students' professional futures.
This is going to be a really great experience to have in your back pocket to know, like, hey, we can look to our peers in other communities for successes and to be able to learn from them and adapt things as needed.
Over in the gym, Nome Belts' spring formal is underway. The students trade their dress shirts and blouses for suits and dresses for one last celebration, Nome style. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
A Juno boy has now undergone a potentially life-saving treatment for a rare genetic disease after years of fundraising. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry has more.
Cade Jobsis just turned 5 years old, and with that birthday, he received gene therapy treatment in Dallas, Texas, a treatment that could save his life. Cade's mother, Emma Jobsis, has been raising money since 2023 through a campaign she built called Cure for Cade. The goal of the funds was to allow scientists to restart clinical trials that previously showed promising results for treating HP4 hereditary spastic paraplegia, or SPG50. Cade was born with the rare disease, which, without treatment, would gradually take away his cognitive and motor function. Cade has struggled to speak and walk. He has been in intensive physical therapy since he was 9 months old.
The hope for this drug, what the research team hopes that it does, is it stops the progression of his disease. Basically, they just kind of slowly become a shell of themselves over time. And the goal of this drug is that it stops that from happening.
Speaking on the phone from Dallas, Jobsis says there already has been damage to Cade's systems, but she doesn't yet know how much can be overcome.
In the best case scenario, this drug will bring back some of the abilities that he's already lost, but we won't know that for certain for a while. It's not something where you just flip a switch and all of a sudden everything is the same. He still has to learn the skills that he hasn't learned yet.
For now, Cade is still in Texas, recovering from the treatment, which gave him some expected flu-like symptoms. He'll travel between Juneau and Texas for follow-up appointments after the treatment, and he'll be on severe immunosuppressants for 6 months, his mom says. The treatment has shown promising results in other children with Cade's condition, but there isn't a big sample size. The treatment is still in clinical trials. which were restarted with $4 million JobSys and other families raised. She says only 7 or 8 kids have received the treatment, so they have very limited data. But that's the point of the trials, she says.
That's what we're doing, is getting the information so that hopefully the next generation of kids with this disease will be able to say, we have a drug and it works and you can get it right away.
JobSys says she's grateful for Juneau residents and businesses. In just the last 6 months, they raised more than $1 million to close the gap left by a grant that fell through. That's on top of previous local fundraising efforts. The money helped restart the trials so Cade and 3 other children with the disease could receive treatment.
We will never be able to repay our town for what they did, for the chance, the hope that they gave us, and to fight with us for Cade.
JobSys says Cade and the family plan to return home at the end of April. She doesn't yet know exactly what the future holds for Cade, but now it's his to discover. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Quemery.
Last week, researchers and local experts gathered to share and compare environmental knowledge in Bethel. As KYUK's Samantha Watson reports, the conference highlighted the power of linking indigenous knowledge and firsthand experience with Western science, particularly across issues facing the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta.
It's the beginning of the Western Alaska Interdisciplinary Science Conference. But before everyone gets down to work, organizer Katie Basil asks them to stop and
think about resilience and abundance in Western Alaska. What does that look like? What foods are available? What languages are spoken? When you walk through that village or town, what do you see and hear?
Basil, who works with the Alaska Sea Grant, which organized the conference, says it's hard not to get bogged down by the difficult issues the region is facing. Many of those problems are informing research presented this week. Salmon fisheries in decline, permafrost erosion, and the devastation of ex-Typhoon Halong. Basil says this gathering is also an opportunity to imagine what things could lead to a better future.
How does our knowledge and research support that vision? What conversations can we have this week that will connect us to a narrative of abundance and resilience?
The conference, also called WASC, was born out of Dillingham. Its founder, UAF professor and environmental researcher Todd Radenbaugh, was passionate about environmental education and felt it was important for scientists and conservationists to convene in the communities where they conducted research. Now, the conference is in its 18th year, and it rotates between Western Alaska communities. Bridging indigenous knowledge, often in the form of oral accounts recalling firsthand experiences with Western science, took center stage at the conference. Joanne Slatz is the mayor of Napakiak, a Kuskokwim River community managing a piecemeal relocation in response to shoreline erosion. She spoke about growing up in the village, back when not everybody had refrigerators or freezers. She remembers bringing home popsicles from the store.
And in order for the package to stay frozen, we had to dig a hole on the ground. And of course, the permafrost was about 2 feet. June, July.
Today, Slatt says stronger fall storms, including October's ex-Typhoon Halong, have been a new piece of the village's relationship with its environment.
We all were changed from the last 2 fall storms, but this one was the worst. The recent one, we just went 90%. In our community, 90% of the homes experienced water getting into their homes.
Much of the research that was presented had similar firsthand accounts and testimonies around the changing environment. Nicole Herman Mercer with the U.S. Geological Survey presented a project that couples collecting interviews with locals and climate data surrounding extreme weather events in YK Delta communities, like the 2022 wildfire that came within 3 miles of the St. Mary's community.
So we set out to develop finer scale climate data coupled with community narratives to create storylines of change
in an attempt to really contextualize the data and make it easier to understand.
Nate Akers of the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge presented on the smolt trap in Queethluck, used for fisheries research. He says community partnerships are essential because they also help connect back to the fundamental why of the data collection.
Better science occurs when local participation and knowledge are included. And they should be included because these projects are to support those various subsistence users and their families and their communities that they come from.
Organizers said a record-breaking 160 people registered to participate at the conference this year. In Bethel, I'm Samantha Watson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone and Yvonne Crumrie in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Ben Townsend in Nome, and Samantha Watson in Bethel. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde, Kirsten Dobroth is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.